All right, y'all, it's spring, and you know what that means. It's time to start planning our summer festival traveling. Yep, it's time to get into my Airbnb bag cross-country, a.k.a. Time to visit my homes all across the country. And you know what I never think about? Why not list my own spot on Airbnb and host some folks at my house? I mean, my house is cute. Yes, let's make money while we're spending money. Just trying to help you out, man, because your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a special Questlove Supreme. Your host Questlove here with Sugar Steve. I'll say that our guests today are the founding trailblazers and New York legends, along with drummer Clem Burke, bassist Lee Fox, guitarist Tommy Kessler, and keyboardist Matt Katz Bohin. They ushered in the very influential punk slash new wave movement. I know musicians hate when things get a title. I often cringe when I hear it. The neo soul title, but you know, this is too legendary to just casually not spot on describe what they represent in the world of music. They to me are the epitome of cool and the epitome of style, and practically dipping their toe into every genre of music that defined a movement and a city: pop, rock, punk, disco, reggae. And they're especially noted for being one of the early co-signers of the burgeoning hip-hop movement. You know, there was a period where the first five, to, depending on who you ask and how conservative they are, 10, maybe 20 years, in which hip-hop was hopefully going to be like a fad that went away, like a flu, that influenza that goes away eventually. But they were one of the very first to co-sign the movement and really brought it to a wider audience, going as far as to use the cachet to bring to light projects like the iconic score to Charlie Ahearn's hip-hop classic Wild Style, and also being one of the first people to introduce hip-hop to a worldwide audience. Of course, the legendary Saturday Night Live episode with the Funky 4+1, that they literally just put their money where their mouth is. And, you know, it's one thing to just say you're down with a movement, but to really use your power, you know, to do so is another. They're currently celebrating the release of their mammoth Against the Odds box set, which basically celebrates the hits, the demos, and the remixes of their illustrious career, over 124 songs in all. This is an honor to say. Please welcome to Questlove Supreme, Chris Stein and Debbie Harry of Blondie. Thank you. I'm the only one clapping today, so just pretend it's like 52 billion people.
That was very, very generous. Thank you.
No, you know, I've been a massive fan of you guys, you know, and so.
Well, likewise.
And I have to say, Debbie, thank you very much for my note. You happen to come on the show. I'm talking about the Tonight Show, in which I was hoping to holler at you for a second before I went on stage, but I had to do something. And then by the time I got off stage, you'd already left because it's like a very long show that we shot that day. But I saw the beautiful note that you left in my dressing room, and I really appreciate that. Thank you very much.
I meant every word of it, even though there were some misspellings and scribbles.
I appreciate it. I appreciate that acknowledgement.
I want to thank Chris for your nice note that you left me on my recording console.
Whatever, Steve. You know, I personally, I want to know, first of all, I really do love the box set. And as a person that's just starting to think about looking under the hood of my own career in terms of, you know, looking at artifacts and going through storage units and all those things, you know, oftentimes you're so present in the moment, you don't realize that the most minuscule thing you have is going to wind up being history 10 years later, you know. So in terms of just getting all these artifacts together and keeping those demos and keeping those tapes and all that stuff, what was the process like? How painstaking was the process in putting this all together?
It went on over a pretty long period. I just had all this stuff, you know, like when we first started making money, you know, I always say the model for the rock star was different back then, or at least for me.
Right.
And Debbie, it was, we didn't think about buying Rolexes and Bentleys and shit. I bought recording equipment. Mm-hmm. So I bought, and guitars. So I had my own old MCI set up, you know, the automation, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And I got around to a bunch of different apartments. We lived in different spaces, and tapes accumulated along with that. And eventually that stuff all died and I gave it all away and stuff. And I wound up with a garage full of tapes upstate New York, which was where we did the assault on the tapes.
Okay.
So like what kind of tape? Like 2-inch tapes or
everything?
Like
everything. Had a lot of 1/2-inch, a lot of 2-inch. I mean, I wound up with a complete copy of the Cuckoo record that we did with Niall and Bernard, and Niall got the whole thing on like just like 2 or 3 tapes because he was running at 7.5, you know.
Oh, really?
He was economical.
I was going to say that at the time, like, when did you realize? I mean, most artists I know are not sentimental at all. There's a story. Well, I mean, he's not a musician, but, you know, I consider him a historian. Don Cornelius, in order to save maybe hundreds of dollars, would, I mean, you know, when it came time to look through the Soul Train archives, you know, the staff there was sad to announce to me that, you know, Don wasn't too sentimental. So, you know, the stage and the lights and the all the designs of the shows, of the Soul Train show within, you know, the 40-year history of it, he just had it all destroyed and crushed and thrown away. And I was like, none of you at all were like, yo, this will be historical one day. Like, we should save this stuff. And, you know, at the time, Don was just thinking like, storage space is too expensive and I can't afford it. So, I mean, oftentimes, you know, I'll tell new artists now, like, don't throw away that concert poster. Don't throw away your itinerary. Don't throw away, I mean, even Prince, like when Prince passed away, like literally anything he wrote on is almost damn near like 5-figure worthy in auctions now, like even directions to the house or you know, Prince was world famous for writing whoever the lady of the moment was, like poetry and stuff, like, you know, I think, yeah. I'm revealing too much, but what I'm basically saying is, did you guys realize in the beginning, like, I should save everything, like, even with, besides the music, like, are you saving the outfits and the wardrobes and old posters or ticket stubs or itineraries?
I got a lot of junk left still, but I know, I mean, it was
so, are you a hoarder?
No, I'm totally. My wife is like, I can't go in there because it's like freaks me out. It's so hoarded out, the room and the, you know, in the basement where we are. You know, there's so much stuff fell by the wayside. I sold so many damn guitars that I could retire now on what those things are worth in today's market, you know. It's just
really,
yeah, it's just crazy.
I would like to know, well, I'll ask the both of you. I'll start with Deborah. What was your first musical memory?
Oh, wow.
I know. Shocker. Sorry.
Oh, that really goes back, doesn't it? I had, children's records back then. I had a Victrola. At least that's what my dad called a Victrola. And it was in a box, a little suitcase. And it had a speaker that was attached to the arm where where the needle was. And you would just drop it down onto the record. And so those were my earliest things. And I think one of my favorites was a thing, oddly enough, called Little Toot.
Little Toot,
yeah.
Was that a Disney record? Or
I don't know if it was a Disney record. It might have been. Might have been. But it was a really great little song that went through a lot of different emotional interpretations, as it told a story of this little tugboat and, the worthlessness of this little tugboat and how the big tugboats always, pushed it around. But then little
made fun of it. Yeah, yeah.
Little Toot became like the hero of the day.
The hero.
Yeah. And
so basically Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer
in tugboats.
In tugboat talk.
Yeah.
Where were you born?
I was born actually in Miami, but I grew up in Hawthorne, New Jersey, which is just outside of Paterson, New Jersey. But my parents and my grandparents lived in Paterson.
Okay. Chris, what was your first musical memory?
Well, I don't really remember locking on to any little kid music. My first affinity for music started when I was like, I guess, around 10 or 11 with movie scores, which was, and some of those novelty songs, like the Chipmunks and Purple People Eater and stuff. But I don't know how much that moved me, that stuff. But then I started, like Lawrence of Arabia, West Side Story. I mean, I it's very hard for me to explain to younger people what a huge cultural touchstone West Side Story was. West Side Story was as big as the damn Beatles. No question about it. Yeah. I don't think people don't get that nowadays.
My mother got so mad at me because I took my sister, who is 7 years younger than me, to see West Side Story, and she almost had a heart attack. Oh no, you took her to see that. Oh no, how could you? But it was fabulous. It was so wonderful. And Leonard Bernstein was never better, really.
I was going to say that, I'm currently reading Little Steven, Steven Van Zandt's autobiography, and he too has an immense obsession with West Side Story, and pretty much described it as the way that you guys did. Like when it came out, it was
revolutionary. It was just such a huge deal. I don't know. I mean, there are probably other soundtracks that I was probably more obsessed with the Lawrence of Arabia soundtrack, Maurice Jarre, which is just a great stuff.
Well, the other thing that I listened to a lot was like the cowboy singers, which is, Western, not even country Western. It was really Western music. And those were great, great songs, and people like Burl Ives and stuff.
Burl Ives, yeah. Burl Ives. Nobody knows who he is now.
Okay, so now that you, declared your love for Lawrence of Arabia, I got to ask you. No, this is important because the very first, I grew up in the household with an older sibling who, because of my sister's, because of her school situation, she was fitting in with her girlfriends, what they were listening to at the time. So, she was bringing in a lot of, the classic new wave and punk stuff or whatever, but the one album that I remember, even though she had like, Each of the Beat and all that stuff, like I remember the day that she brought Auto American.
Okay. So there, on the orchestral session, there was one of the bass players played on the Lawrence of Arabia soundtrack.
Right.
And
okay.
That was it.
I was going to ask, is your obsession because, the way that you open up Auto American with the Europa score.
Yeah, I mean, that by then I was into Nino Rota very deep and all this other stuff, I always had a thing for soundtracks. I think soundtracks nowadays, that's a whole other topic, are way overused. they're becoming like laugh tracks, you know, where they steer your emotions in the direction of where whoever the committee that wrote the thing think you should be feeling, you know. And then, you know, gradually I started assimilating the pop music that was around me, like Locomotion. Everybody loved Locomotion, no matter what, you know. And this, you know, this stuff, like the Shangri-Las, I didn't really appreciate till a little later when we were doing the band. I was kind of like commercial to me at the time, you know.
Well, I'm older than Chris, and I remember this thing. I used to listen to radio a lot. I had a little radio, and I always had my ear right next to the speaker. Mm-hmm. The speaker was only, you know, about this big. And they had a radio thing called the Hit Parade.
Yeah.
And all those, like, crooners and, you know, band singers and stuff like that. It was a lot of that. It was kind of great.
Yeah, that's even before.
Yeah.
And then I went into folk music, of course, you know, because I was 15 and 65. And by that time, I'd been playing guitar since I was 12. And folk music was it. And I remember learning how to play House of the Rising Sun was such a big deal to me, you know. So,
can you describe to me what the New York nightclub scene was in terms of like the pre-punk, the pre-new wave movement? Like if it's 74, if it's 73 or 74, you know, where are you playing or like where are you hanging out at least?
Well, we met, Debbie was doing a show in a bar. So I didn't go out to many clubs before I was in the band situation. I mean, Maxis was kind of the first thing I was going to regularly.
Mostly it was bars, you know, people just setting up on the floor in bars and stuff. And then a little bit later on, they officially became clubs. But initially, they were bars.
Okay.
I mean, the stuff that we were involved with was like Mercer Arts Center came out of the art scene. I mean, Max's was an art bar. You know, all those guys, all those people went on to be famous. And the art world had tabs at Max's, you know.
The post-Warhol movement or?
Or Andy. You know, he was always in the middle of everything.
Okay.
All for us, anyway. For, you know, he was just there. He was a staple.
I wanted to know, well, they mentioned Max's Kansas City, and it's hard not to think of the Velvet Underground. Did you guys see the Velvet Underground play live there at all?
I opened up for the Velvets when I was 17.
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was amazing, and it was a pivotal moment in my musical life. And they were playing in a place uptown called the Gymnasium, which was Andy had connections to these Polish hall people, you know, who were in these old world halls, and this place was the Gymnasium and also did shows. This was 1967. Me and my friends all knew who the Velvets were at that point. And I had a really close friend, a guy I grew up with, known for 50 years, who was working for Andy at the time. His name is Joey Freeman. He's still my buddy. And he showed up at my house in Brooklyn one afternoon, and he said, listen, the opening band for the Velvets didn't show up. Do you guys want to do it? So we took our guitars on the subway and we went uptown. It was like up in the west side somewhere, 70s or so, 60s or 70s. And the Velvets let us use their amps, and Maureen Tucker let us put her bass drum upright, you know, because she only played it like a timpani, you know, on its side. And they were nice, and we played our blues rock set. You know, I don't remember. I only remember we did You Can't Judge a Book by Its Cover, but I don't remember much of the other stuff, you know, like Route 66, that kind of junk we were doing. And we were really daunted because this place was big and echoey, and there was like, not, there weren't too many people there, but then the Velvets came on and they took advantage of the echo. And that was also a life lesson for me because, you know, the place you're playing in becomes a part of your sound system. You know, people don't get that, you know, unless you're doing this all the time. And they were awesome and filled the room. And Andy was there. We never saw him. And somebody came over and said, oh, Andy thinks you're great. That was terrific. And that was the event. But it was a really wonderful thing.
I saw them at this place called the Balloon Farm.
Balloon Farm, yeah.
Yeah, on St. Mark's Place. And Andy was doing the lights, And Nico was with them that night, and it was beautiful. It was just, I mean, beautiful visually and in sound wise, and everything about it was beautiful.
Yo, what's up? This is Fonte, Fontigolo from Team Supreme. Black representation in media is very important to me. I think it's important to have our stories told by people who look like us and who have shared in our common experiences. Some of my earliest influences were Donnie Simpson. I would also say Tom Joyner, Angela Stribling, Sherry Carter. They were just people who told our stories with a lot of class and dignity and were big inspirations to me. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black stories, Black truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcast, The Center Black Voices. It's NPR Noir. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR. Wherever you get podcasts.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Like, I know that you were in separate bands, or could you tell us how the band came to be? As far as, you know, the official start of Blondie?
Well, the scene was very incestuous, and we all had mutual friends, though the two of us had never met. We think we both were at Woodstock, but we didn't meet there. Debbie right. had a job working for the first head shop in New York, which was called The Head Shop, which was on East 9th Street. And I remember going in there the day
the
before
head shop? It opened.
Yeah, it's called The Head Shop.
What is a head shop?
What oh is a head God. Shop? They sell, yeah, bongs and posters and rolling papers and weed supply, you know. But it was where you been?
And dog, I'm sorry, I'm the 40-year-old virgin.
And, you know, it was a little more clandestine, and it wasn't like, it was kind of understated that it was all based on weed consumption.
I never knew that it was called a head shop.
Head shop, yeah, sure, head shop.
Well, so because where I grew up, it was always the, you know, you always at the mom and pop record store.
Yeah, right, yeah.
I would assume that the guy also sold weed because, you know, just the smell of the record store mixed with, you know, Lysol and incense, like to try to.
Well, the head shops wouldn't back then. In the 60s, wouldn't sell weed because they were too big a target. You know, they would just sell the stuff.
Accoutrement. You know? I got it.
Yeah. So I was in the head shop the day before it opened talking to a girl. And okay. For all I know, that was us, and we talked to each other. But 3 years later, 4 years later, I guess I was like 69 or 60 or 70 or something like that, then... You know, everybody knew each other, and I had friends, and one of my friends, you know, it's a very long story, but a mutual friend said, I heard about this band playing called the Stilettos, Girl Singers, go see them. And that was Debbie and two other girls. So that was it.
Did that band have any kind of startup or success, Debbie, you and the other two girls?
Well, yeah, I mean, we had a small amount of notoriety, I suppose, and interest. I don't think there was any real reality as far as, you know, a professional career or, you know, recording or anything like that. Everything we did was,
you know. Did some stuff with the Dolls. We did stuff with the Dolls, remember, later on?
Yeah.
You guys sang back up in a couple of Dolls shows and stuff.
Yeah. Oh, right. Was that 82?
Yeah, maybe, or an Uptown.
I think there's a picture of us at 82.
Yeah.
82 was another club that that existed sort of in a even darker way than Max's or CBGB's. It was an old transvestite club from the 1940s.
Yeah, it was very gangster.
Yeah.
It was number 82 East 3rd Street, I guess, or
something like that. Yeah.
Something like a second, first street. All the way east, and it was in a basement. That was a great scene. A lot of bands played there. Bowie went there. All the stuff went on there. There's not a lot of info on it.
Okay, so one of my favorite kind of underground New York labels was Private Stock.
Oh, and, no.
Well, no, a lot of legendary records were on there, and especially for hip-hoppers, there's like incredible breakbeats on there, but I got to know, like, what was it like dealing with Larry Utel?
Larry had come out of, like, the Brill Building scene. He had been a part of Bell Records with I think, Seymour and Marty
Seymour Stein.
Yeah.
They were all like partners at one point, and then they split, went their different ways. Marty Thau, you know, managed the Dolls all through their early heyday in the first records and all that stuff. Before McLaren picked up on him. And Larry was, you know, it was kind of a vanity project for him. I mean, I think his daughter, Jody, who was like the press person, had a better idea what was going on in the reality of the street music, you know, that was coming out of the streets. Larry was like, you know, Larry, you know, guy with the open shirt and the big gold chain around his neck. And
well, he did
stuff,
what
you
know. he liked. He was friends with the girls don't cry. You know, that one.
Oh, Frankie.
Valley.
Valley and the team.
Right, yeah, Frankie Valley was on the label, right?
Yeah,
that was their big act. And Peter Lemongello, man.
Peter Lemongello.
You know what Peter Lemongello was? Peter Lemongello was like his M-O-R singer, but the girls liked him because he was like sexy, you know, thing.
That helps.
And then they had
being sexy.
Then they had Fifth of Beethoven also on the label, which was
Walter, now Samantha Sang. Yeah.
It was an odd place to be for us.
Yeah.
It was very odd. And we tried.
You know, we live in a time now which, you know, literally you can create a fully produced and realized album on your laptop.
Right.
But what is the process of getting a demo? Like, okay, you're going to start a band. Now, I mean, at any point, are you guys like, hey, we're just hanging around doing the scene? Or are you guys like actively like, we're trying to get a record deal?
Yeah, I mean, that was the goal, was to get the music out. Everybody knew, I mean, we all grew up with records and records being very important to us. So that was, of course, a goal. But in New York, so there was, I don't know, 100 bands instead of 100,000 bands, the way it is now, you know. So that made a big difference.
I always wanted to know this, and I know it's a Captain Obvious question, but What was the actual reason why you guys settled on the name Blondie?
We had been trying to pick out a name. And I mean, you know, you search for a name, and we called ourselves Angel and the Snake for a few months. And that was sort of, you know, it wasn't really It would have been a good name for nowadays, but at that point,
for a metal band, yeah, maybe, you know.
Yeah.
But
right.
Well, we wanted to be a metal band, but
I don't know if we even had that much of a. No. I don't know what we wanted to be anything.
Well, I was as a beautician. I was working in New Jersey as a beautician, and you know, during slow hours, you know, we would do each other's hair. And so one day they did me, and I was, you know, had blonde hair, and walking to Chris's house, you know, I was getting, you know, some street noise. Hey, Blondie. And I just said, oh, okay, well, that'll work. And that was that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I always thought it was a Blondie Dagwood reference.
Well, it became that. Yeah,
we were aware of that. And, yeah. You know, and those guys never bothered us. For all the time, there was never any.
Y'all look tough as shit, yo. Like,
yeah. No, I mean, there was never any complaints about us commandeering the name or anything from the comic people.
Oh,
you know?
Mean that? I thought you meant just in New York.
No, everybody bothered. But... Forget about that shit. we got bothered a lot in New York.
To be fair, I did say to the guys, you know, when we started getting, you know, official attention, that they should all bleach their hair, you know, and be like wrestlers, you know, and the guys really? Should all have blonde hair. And we'd all have blonde hair. But no, nobody wanted to do it.
Just while we're on the name Blondie. So by now, of course, we all know your name is Debbie Harry. But people must have been calling you personally Blondie this whole time. Is that disturbing
to
bother you, or is that something that you just gotten used to, or do you say, hey, my name's Debbie, you know, the band is Blondie?
Well, I think there was that, you know, kind of the definition thing for a while. I didn't mind especially being called Blondie because I had the blonde hair, and you know, basically, you know, I guess little boys get called that too, you know, hey Blondie, but usually, you know, little girls with my coloring, you know, are called Blondie very often. So it didn't really bother me. It did bother me, you know, that we had to sort of identify ourselves constantly. But I think that, you know, I guess it's something that you learn, right? You learn that you have to identify yourself.
Well, as I said at the top of the show, people will often lump you guys in with the punk movement or the new wave movement. You know, it's kind of like I didn't necessarily think that you were either, because for me, at least with the first three records, like from the self-titled record to Parallel Lines, you know, there's a heavy sort of post, I guess you could say, wall of sound feel in there, like in terms of like a very updated, like an updated kind of Spectre-ish thing going on. Mm-hmm. So for you, was it always an eye-rolling thing if, you know, critics that obviously weren't on the scene that were, like, hanging around to see, like, was it weird to get typecast to be part of a movement that really, I don't know, I think between you guys and the Police, like, even though you're lumped in with this movement, you guys really weren't that level of punk to me. Like, you guys were more of a stylish... At least how it looked to me when I was like 9 or 10 years old.
I think the punk form is much more defined nowadays, and you know, in 2020 onward, you know, you got all these bands, you know, Surfport and Amyl and the Sniffers, and
right.
All these guys are very defined in their punkness. You know, when you think about, you know, us and Television and Talking Heads and Patty. It was very diverse, that kind of sound, and it wasn't so. I mean, the Ramones were very much in their own groove with the thing, but they were specifically them, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there was rockabilly. There, you know, was the sort of art rock, you know, blues. It was all a punk scene, and it incorporated a lot of different styles of music, which you know, we were. Actually experimenting with, you know, and trying to pull in, you know, references that, you know, sort of befitted a girl singer and, you know, a rock band and with, you know, attitude, you know. I think for me, I wanted to be a punk. I felt like I had enough attitude, but
the punk definition was very much like a lifestyle thing, the way a hippie was, you know. Yeah. It was, you know, it was like stylistic and about do it yourself, very much about do it yourself,
yeah,
too. And you know, and then there was a backlash against all the real heavy MOR stuff that was happening in the mid 70s then, that was, you know, above ground, you know, whatever, you know, the Eagles and Linda Ronstadt and stuff was pretty,
right,
you know, sedate for us, you know.
At that time, socially, who were your peers of that movement? Like, were you friendly with the Ramones or the New York Dolls?
Yeah, Ramones. We were very close to Ramones and the Dolls. There were kind of two camps at CV's of the art rock people and the pop rock people. And we were kind of in the pop rock side, you know, and it was a band called the Miamis. It was a band called the Fast. You know, those people.
Richard Hell.
Yeah. Johnny. Heartbreakers were a great band.
Yeah.
All that stuff, you know.
I believe that my band was the second or the third to last act to play at CBGB's. I got to know, was that nice bathroom always filthy?
The bathroom used to be upstairs, and the stage used to be on the left, facing the stage. And then it moved to the right, and the bathroom moved downstairs and got even worse. It was probably a little less gross when it was upstairs.
Yeah.
I see. Any fond memories there? I hate being that person that's like salivating over, like, again, these folklore stories of clubs of yore, and you guys are just like, whatever, we showed up and we played. But, you know, at any point during that period, did you know that this was like the zeitgeist of the scene? Or, again, was it just hey, it's Thursday night, we're playing?
Yeah, no, we were pretty much in the moment, you know. And what I also say is everybody, every single person I knew would say, this is, New York is so horrible, I just got to get out of here, I can't stand it anymore, but nobody left. And there's this great Lou Reed monologue where he talks about how awful it is in New York for him, but how much more uncomfortable he is everywhere else. So that was that, pretty much. But yeah, I mean, lots of crazy shit went down at CB's all the time, Max's too. It was, you know.
Well, it went through stages, you know, stages of development, because it wasn't like a full on, you know, big club scene from the start. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a biker bar with, you know, some, you know, Bowery guys, you know, Alkies and stuff that hung out at this bar. And then for some reason, Hilly, you know, started having music. And, you know, I have suspicions about, you know, there used to be a club restaurant on 9th Street, right off of 6th Avenue, between 5th and 6th. And it was called Hilly's. I somehow think that Hilly was involved with that. And
no, he ran a couple of bars. Yeah, I think he had one that was like downstairs from Trudy Heller's too at one point.
Oh, really?
Oh. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. He had a couple of bars around town.
Yeah.
And he was a singer also. He had a country single on the jukebox in CBGB's that I don't really hear people talking about too much. I don't remember what the heck it was, but it was there.
New York is great for clubs, you know. I mean, it's always been that way. It's great.
How often is the rotation? I know that for me, in Philadelphia, there's really only, at least for the Roots, like, maybe if you're lucky, there's like six clubs to play.
Yeah.
Because we also had like, you know, five or six major colleges there. So, you know, where you play at University of Penn, play at Temple, play, you know, you would just go to where the colleges were. But as far as rotation is concerned.
Well, there was a thing where if you played at Max's, you shouldn't play at CB's the next weekend. You had to like wait a week. But there were other little bars. There was like Broadway Charlie's and a place called the Mushroom and that Monty Python bar. And all these little things.
Mothers
was on Tony, right across from the Chelsea. There was a, and my father's place was up in what, Long Island City, that, you know, stuff would come and go.
I would assume that, you know, by the time, at least by the time you guys get to Chrysalis, that, you know, you're not, you're no longer a, like a local rock band, and you're also doing national and going out of state and whatnot. So,
yeah,
all that stuff went on, but it's still the, you know, the other thing people may not get nowadays is what a goddamn Wild West show the music industry was, the touring in those days. It was, now it's so slick. You know, you got Live Nation, all this stuff, you know, boom, you go there.
I was going to say, dead, what, man. Was there such thing as a rider? Like, okay. Because I ask each act to do this for me, because I truly want to know, you know, and the thing you mentioned at the top about the Rolexes and all that stuff. Yes, I'm in the hip hop generation, especially the first generation of like post hype William videos, where around 94, I would say that, yes, like even coming into the game, like we came into the game with two tour buses and a really good rider and Musilix and like, you know, like where's the manicurist at? Like that sort of shit.
So we did a fucking, we did a tour of Australia.
Oh, and
we were in like a school bus, man. That was it. Like
let
a
me know.
Double old school with like, that was filled with dust, you know, and we had like a, in America, when we went on the tour with Iggy and Bowie, we were in an RV, which was like really crappy and falling apart. I remember too. So all that kind of stuff was yeah.
All right. So let's skip to Parallel Lines. Can you walk me through the process? Like, okay, so the idea of like tour buses and good hotel lodging, like at what point does that even happen? Or is that something that was just invented in the 90s? Like,
yeah, comfort. I'm gonna go with 90s.
Damn.
Because yeah, we had some, man, it was, you know, there was a lot of, we briefly
live for these nerd stories, so don't think you're like sparing us by like, you don't want to hear about the time when Bowie stole our lunch meat or something.
We never flew private. There was just no such thing. But okay. Like briefly, I remember there was like 10 minutes when we were with Shep Gordon. There was like, in Europe, we had a little four-seater jet for a couple of publicity dates. But that was like, you know, two flights or something like that. We went on the Concorde. We were on the fucking Concorde a bunch of times. That was nice.
Yeah.
I was going to say, Shep is one of my closest friends. And what time does he enter managing the band?
I think the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he was there for Parallel Lines?
No.
No, no. That was
E to the Beat?
Previous guy.
It was towards the very end. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, Auto American. Yeah. I know he was there
Auto
for that.
Auto American and The Hunter, which was, you know, the least successful.
Yeah.
The Auto American platinum plaque is hanging up above the guest bedroom. So
nice.
You guys, Teddy Pendergrass and Luther Vandross records. Yeah.
Oh, I like that.
Are above, when I stay at his house in his guest room. So with Parallel Lines, at least, which, you know, many consider that to be like your super breakthrough with it. Can you talk about the making of Heart of Glass, aka Once I Had a Love, and bringing that forth?
Well, it was all about the getting the Roland rhythm machine hooked up with the Roland, whatever the hell, I can't remember. I should know this off my head, but I don't.
Was there MIDI back in the day?
No, it was all voltage, VCI, voltage controlled, you know.
Okay.
So it was pre-MIDI, and that was such a huge deal. That's where the whole song was built up on, the synth being hooked to the rhythm machine, and everything was built around that. You know, we had the chords and stuff and the structure, somewhat. You know,
very time consuming.
Yes. Well, I mean, going in with Chapman was great. I mean, Chapman was a master, and he was at the peak of his game, and we were also at the peak of analog too. It was at the high point of fucking analog. You know, he had the one. The digital reverb, I guess it's, I don't know, Eventide or whatever the heck that it is. Mm-hmm. He had that one unit, but everything else was just like that. And I'm glad we got to be there at that moment too. But Chapman was great. He was like going in with George Martin for us. It was like a whole, you know, he was like the extra member of the band. It was just, it was fantastic. And we all, you know, he beat the heck out of us, but it was great.
I was going to ask with, because the thing is that, you know, Heart of Glass was even more than Miss You. I feel like Heart of Glass is like the perfect dance song that's not blatantly a disco song. Not to say that Miss You by the Rolling Stones was a blatant. Yeah, people seem to consider anything with Four on the Floor to be disco. But I always wanted to know, obviously, there had to have been some sort of conscious decision like, okay, let's make something accessible.
We thought we sounded like Kraftwerk. We were referencing Kraftwerk.
Oh, okay.
That was it. Not so much disco music.
But I always wanted to know, like, for such a song that has such a steady Four on the Floor pace, why was there a decision to make the last bridge into 7/8 meter?
Which I don't know if that was an accident or not. I mean, Chapman would edit, fucking slice the 2-inch tape with a fucking razor, which is kind of unheard of.
No, you know? Guys were playing. Which I was like, wait a minute.
It's that one little section. I mean, I'm sure if you asked everybody would have a different opinion about why that came about, whether it was accidental or not. I don't know.
You know, Heart of Glass seems very accessible to play at a jam session, but there's always that moment right after the last. There's always that moment right on the course where I'm looking at the people like, wait, are we about to do To the Lever? Are we going to do the 7/8 part? We're just going to act like the beginning. And then it's always a car crash.
Well, that's very gratifying.
Thank you. It's made it all worthwhile.
The drums are all pieced together the way a disco record. I mean, the bass drum's recorded by itself. Top kit. Yeah. The top kit's recorded by itself, you know. Yeah, that was the only song like that. That was the only one that was done like that.
What was the logic behind that? A better mix to it?
Mike had done some kind of disco music. Yeah, maybe be able to bring out the kick a little more. I don't know.
Oh, okay. Okay. I see that.
I think it was his ears, you know. I mean, he had those ears, you know.
What studio was this at? Parallel Lines?
It'd be Power Station, right?
Power Station, yeah, or record plant or Power Station, yeah.
At the time of Parallel Lines, and now, I guess, also, which do you enjoy more, playing live or making records?
I like recording. I'm a recording guy. Always. Yeah. I'm not doing a tour, but that's mostly because of health stuff. But they got a replacement for me lately. But I think Debbie probably both. Maybe I know she gets off on doing the shows a lot. I mean, I like doing the shows. I always love doing the shows. But I've been doing recording ever since I was a little kid. Man, I was screwing around with, you know, old wall and sack reel to reel recorders and stuff like that. And I would always have a TAC 4-track that if I could beg, borrow, or steal. So I mean, that's just part of my life is doing recording. I love the laptop digital stuff. Go sitting with Logic for hours and tweaking stuff.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. 'Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cb for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Does the music creative decisions start with the two of you, or is it an actual democracy in which
it's six of you, it's a monarchic democracy. So
passive aggressive dictatorship.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, what do you guys think? Okay, this is what we're going to do. So,
yeah, I mean, I always managed to get a lot of, by that time we had been, so the only song that we, before we recorded it, I knew was going to be a hit is Tide Is High. I mean, the other ones, I wasn't sure, but I knew if we could pull up a decent recording of Tide Is High, that it would be successful.
Were you a fan of the Paragons original or?
Yeah, the original is Godhead. And it's probably the only reggae song I ever heard that has a violin in it from that period. Which is similar. So the horn lines are based on the violin line.
This is what I have to figure out. There's about 9 mammoth songs in E minor that come out in the first half of 1980. 9 mammoth dance floor rockers in E minor. I will ask this much. Was Good Times that much of an influential song that it's almost like, was it unavoidable? Because, when I ask some of these people, when I ask, the other artists this question, some of them say like sometimes you just subconsciously go there without purposely trying to go there. Whereas Brian may confirm or may not confirm that Another One Bites the Dust was exactly, what's our version of Good Times?
Yeah, no, Rapture was total homage to Chic.
Okay, you know, I just wanted to know.
no question about it. I mean, I was totally thinking of that. The bass line is the first thing that came up.
Yeah, that was an extreme radical thing to do. Like, of all the songs in your catalog, that was super, super risky. Could you just talk about how does hip-hop reach you as a New Yorker? Like, were you aware of what was happening in the Bronx, or?
Yeah, I really wasn't that aware. We'd heard Rapper's Delight, on the radio, a couple of things. But then we hooked up with Freddie, and Freddie, I guess it was 77, took us up to this event at a police athletic league up in the Bronx. And that was like just this eye-opening experience. You know, it was.
Wait, what year did you meet Fat Five Freddie?
Probably 76 or 7.
Oh, damn. Okay. Long time ago.
Yeah, I mean, I've gone over the date with him trying to figure out what year that was. And he thinks 77 was when we went up to this thing.
One of my all-time, I won't say great punishment stories, was kind of like a fist fight that I almost got into with my cousin. Because, at this point, it's the summer of 1981. And he's singing, like, I don't know where we're coming from. We were coming from, like, my grandmom's house. He was walking from the corner store and going back home. And he's singing to himself. And he's like, fast, 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 cool. And I was like, wait, why do you repeat that 3 times? And he's like, because that's how the song goes. Flash is fast, flash is fast, flash is fast. I said, no, it doesn't. She says,
no, it doesn't.
So basically, my cousin never heard of Rapture, and I never heard of The Adventures of Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel, which for hip hop historians is basically the first time that the world is hearing what cutting and scratching is like. You know, Grandmaster Flash goes in the studio and he does a 7-minute open format demonstration of the records of the day. You know, it takes Sheik's Good Times and Apache and Rapture and, you know, just the party songs of the moment, and does a demonstration of what scratching is. You know, because for most hip-hop records, you know, you'd have to get a band, get Keith LeBlanc or whatever to redo the breaks and whatnot, because technology wasn't there yet. And so, you know, of course, my level of know-it-all snobbery, you know, I was so angered. Like, he then knew he could get my goat, so he would just sing it, like, anytime he just wanted to fuck with me, he'd just be like, flash is fast, flash is fast, flash is fast, flash is flash, and I'm like, motherfucker! And then we just, you know, and then, you know, we got put on punishment. So, you know, at the time, like, for you, were you shocked at the reception? Were you nervous about it? Or for you, was it just like, this might be filler on the album, or like, yo, this shit's going to go to number one?
Frankie Crocker was a major component in that song.
I forgot.
That's, yeah.
If it goes to Paradise Garage, it's going to Frankie Crocker, then it's going to the world. Okay.
Yeah, he was a big supporter, and we are eternally grateful.
Yeah.
I mean, at that moment, did you realize you were seeing a revolution at the time, or was it just like...
No, because, you know, it's funny what you said earlier about being a fad, because I was up there with all these record company guys and people on the inside of the industry, and 99% of them all said, oh, it's a fad, it's going to go away.
They said that about punk, too. I mean, I guess that was their favorite thing to say, you know. And the other thing was, when Kiss... When every time that there was a technological advancement or, you know, update, it's not going to last. That was the big thing to say. Oh, it's not going to last.
One of the first things I did when I started working here at 30 Rock, which, of course, you know, where The Tonight Show is and SNL and all these like legendary shows, there's a giant database system that's hooked up to all of our computers. So any episode of SNL I want to watch, like, you can't get it on YouTube, but I can sit here for days and go through the archives. How hard was it for you guys to actually broker that deal so that the Funky 4+1 gets on SNL?
The real hard aspect of the Funkees being on the show was trying to get them to scratch.
I
couldn't get it done. And even there was a moment when they even got a limousine and sent two of them uptown to get a cable. You know, that didn't work. They just couldn't get it done. They went on to a tape, and then they also went on the crawl at the end of the show, you know, with under the credits. But
right.
It was still, but you know, I mean, Chirac is still by many considered the first female rapper, you know? So,
yeah. Well, no, that to me was a credible cosign, because, you know, they were, to me, like the epitome. And, you know, the fact that you didn't see female MCs that much and they could have been like, hey, go with someone, go with Flash and them, or go with the Sugar Hill Gang. And the fact that
we were buddies with those guys. I hung out with Rodney for many years, you know. So
legendary Rodney C.
Rodney C.
So get into it. So how did you meet with Charlie Ahearn and your involvement with Wild Style? Are you shocked at all that suddenly, not even suddenly, well, I'll say that a good 15 years after you create these tracks, that suddenly, like, they do become sort of like a staple of hip-hop culture, at least, like, us using those breaks for real, not just for the purpose of Wild Style.
I'm shocked. I mean, What I did was aware of when I told Charlie at the time was, you know, as soon as this thing comes out, there's going to be 100 Hollywood movies like this. And like Beat Street was like immediately thereafter, like a bigger budget version, you know. But it was great. It was just all people that we worked with. It was a part of the TV party milieu, that whole thing, you know.
Right.
I mean, I think Lenny plays drums on some of that stuff. And he was in the TV party orchestra.
Yeah, I was going to say, who's the other... The Blondie guys are not playing on that, right?
No, it's just I came into the studio with my old Roland synth guitar and put tracks on top of what was already had been recorded, which was bass and drums. And then Freddie did like those sound effects of like electric razors and all kinds of weird stuff that he did. And
so wait, who did the bass and the drums?
I might be Lenny. I'm not sure. You got to ask Charlie on this. Yeah. I never got together with him. I did those tracks with Kaz, and I only met Kaz like 3 years ago for the first time, you know?
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And that one track that I did with Kaz, I tried to sync synthesizers up to the scratching by just taking the line out of the scratching track and putting it into the voltage controlled input of the synth. So that actually is happening on, I don't even know if that's been done since. It's a little chaotic.
Yeah, I was about to say, that's very primitive level of of making that stuff. Who has the master tapes to those sessions?
Charlie, I guess, he's in control of that whole thing. I might have copies up in the tapes. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I was about to say, Down by Law might be like one of my all-time favorite.
Everybody gravitated towards that, and it was so smart that they pressed up vinyls and gave them out to the people who were doing the shows that were being filmed.
Right.
You know, but they all gravitated towards that one track, too.
I was going to say, like, how many copies of those instrumentals were made?
Initially, I don't know, 20 to 50, maybe.
Oh, okay.
But then, you know, it's been repressed and re-released on like a white label thing that's like simulates the, I mean, I would go to the UK and I had guys come up to me and beg me for copies of the original. I didn't have any good control.
Yeah, I think like they reprinted them, at least the instrumentals, like, you know, around like 93, 94. So,
yeah.
But for the longest, you know, I couldn't find any of those things, and was
that
wondering.
Basketball throwdown sequence is like the greatest goddamn thing to me. It's never been done since, you know, and they did a lot of takes to get that, but it's you know, you can find it on YouTube. It's just awesome.
Hey, Deb, I wanted to ask about your first solo outing, working with Nile. You did Backfired and
Cuckoo.
Yes. Could you talk about the process of making it? Like, had you always wanted to do your own solo stuff, or?
Oh, well, I think it became apparent, you know, that we, you know, I guess had divergent interests, you know, mm-hmm. with the Blondie format. And as you know, in the record industry, as you well probably know, that, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of times the labels reject, you know, you changing. And, you know, Chris and I were, you know, we liked a lot of different things. And we especially liked Chic, you know, we liked Niall and Bernard mm-hmm. and Donna Summer. So, you know, I guess we just got to know Niall a little bit. Bernard was a little more quiet. Niall was out there, you know. He was very social.
He was.
And yeah. So
and one of the first times we met him, he was going on about how much he loved Devo, which was, you know, and he said to this day, he says he didn't know much about rap music, and that we were the ones who introduced him. So that seems strange to me, but okay.
That he's the proprietor of, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a common story where, you know, when he was alive, I'd always tease Prince about the fact that, you know, Prince, is a very famous, lurker on the internet, you know, would often kind of proverbial eye roll whenever I talked about, you know, his Diamonds and Pearls, gangster rap period, you know, with the gun mic and all that stuff. And, you know, I would tell him all the time that you were actually more hip hop before you were rapping on purpose. You know what I mean? Because everything about him was, you know, was that. It was, you know, he's drum programming, he was ghostwriting, you know, he was making up his own groups and had aliases, like everything that was hip hop, even down to like the women that he chose to market it, like all that was, that was the blueprint that hip hop built itself upon. You know what I'm saying? And so oftentimes I just find it weird that the second that he becomes aware of hip hop, then that's sort of like, that's where it got weird. But he was, to me, 100% hip hop before he sort of became aware of it. So you telling the story of now Rogers, like really not being into it, even though the irony of the Good Times thing. Can you speak upon like the circumstances after 82 and the band wanting to take a break? Was it just because you guys were just on a 10-year stretch by that point?
And oh, no, we were all you just fucked needed up on drugs. I got really sick. I had this long, protracted illness. Mm-hmm. Just all kinds of crap was going on. You know, our finances went to shit. We got victimized in a lot of places. We found out this accountant we had, the 2 years we made the most money, didn't pay our taxes, just tried to get us into tax shelters. So
yikes.
Yeah, it's just standard showbiz bullshit, you know?
You know, at this point when you're celebrating your entire history, like for you, what's the biggest lesson that you've learned?
Oh, geez. Well, there's a lot, you know, just relax, be yourself. Don't trust anybody. You know, just the basic stuff. It's all going to sound so cliche.
We love cliches on this show.
Yeah.
Like, because to me, it's about the creative process, but it's also about, you know, what have you learned in hindsight? You know, I mean, I just love the fact that you saved all those demos.
Yeah.
I, for one, wasn't too sentimental with the demo. I was smart enough to not throw them away, but now I'm going through the painstaking process of just going through trash bin after trash bin after, because I know like in 10 years, I'm going to have to make some sort of sense of it. So can you just talk about the process of finding these things? And
that was long and arduous. You know, we did the last Blondie album we did at the Magic Shop, and Steve there, you know, the place where Bowie did Black Star, you know, he did his last two records there, and phenomenal amount of stuff came out of that place in Soho. We were like the last band to record there. And Steve there has the record tape salvaging company also, you know, he bakes the tapes and does all that stuff. So that was easy. I turned it over to him, and our manager, Tommy, oversaw the thing. And, you know, I would get these millions of little fragments on Dropbox and listen to stuff and go, yeah, this is cool, whatever, et cetera.
So, Chris, what was like the coolest thing that you found in the archives, personally to you, where you were excited about what you found?
Did we have a version of Moonlight Drive by the Doors that we recorded in the studio while we were doing either the first or second album, which is really great. But whoever was sitting in the control room didn't hit record at the top of the song. So they did a good job of coming in after the first movement. But and it's, you know, that I don't know that I was aware that existed even, but that's out there.
Wow. And that's on the box set?
Yeah, that's on the box set. Yeah, it's a cool thing.
Did you fade it in on the box set, or did you just start it with
it starts with some drums, but it, you know, it misses the whole little intro section. First verse. Yeah.
Fired him.
It's cool though.
Could you briefly talk about so at one point you guys were gonna work with Giorgio Moroder?
Yeah. Well, Giorgio didn't want to put up with the band bullshit and all the egomania and us having to play things 100 times to get it right and all that stuff. He's just wants to go in there and get it done.
One and done. So you're saying that your process was more meticulous in terms of like wanting to do, because you guys are super tight as a band. I was going to ask, like,
no, it's quite the opposite. the really? Opposite. We were sloppy and would have to go over shit a lot to get it done. I mean, after a while, by now people have their skills honed, but in the early Blondie days, it was pretty funky.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, the way that you executed Call Me, at least, you know, I you guys were airtight by then, you know, so I...
Yeah, but Call Me has a lot of Giorgio's session guys on it as well as the band, you know? Yeah, I mean, Clem's on there for sure.
But okay.
I'm not even 100% on who's what in that track.
Okay, I see. But I do want to know, in closing, just where are you now as far as like creativity is concerned and still...
Well, we just finished a 12th record with right. John Congleton, and that's very exciting. It's a little more raw than the previous one. I've been listening to the mixes coming back. It's great. I'm excited to get it out in the world.
When do you propose that will be ready?
Next year.
Okay.
I have a final question, Quest, if you don't mind.
Yes.
It's kind of, I ask a lot of people from your generation, especially about their vinyl record collections from your past. Do you still have your vinyl?
Yeah, I still have them, but I'm happy to listen to digital stuff at this point. You know, it's like digital. I do a lot of photography still, and I'm not going to go back to film. You know, I mean, I like film. It's nice, but it's also kind of like a fetish.
But you still have a turntable.
Yeah, but I haven't put anything on it in 10 years or whatever. You know. Yeah, I know you guys are purists.
Sorry, Steve. No.
It's nice that he still has his collection. You know, a lot of people.
Yeah, no, I got plenty of stuff. I got Charles Manson's record. I got the first pressing.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
What was I watching? I was just watching some dumb TV show and they closed with a Charles Manson song. What the heck was that? I can't really remember. Yeah.
But for you, okay, so for you, what's in your top five records of all time?
Oh, man. Well, that's a lot. You know what John Fahey is?
I know John Fahey, yeah.
John Fahey's like a superhero to me. I saw him play. I even talked to him briefly. Top five. Beyond that, just, you know, standard stuff. What you consider, you know, like Bowie records. Like, I was at Studio 54, and when James Brown has that double
album. Oh, no.
Yeah, I saw one of those shows.
It's funny you say that. For James Brown fans, I will personally say that the thing that I admire most about James Brown is that he doesn't know mediocrity. So either either he will be the height of perfection, or it's the worst shit ever. And as a kid, I remember saving, like, seeing James Brown live at Studio 54. And, you know, this is when I'm first starting to discover breakbeats and everything. So I was like, oh, man, look at the cover. He's sweating. Oh, it's going to be real good. And I brought it home, and I was like, ah, this is the worst. So
yeah, no, I was at one of those shows. I don't know if it was the one that are on the record, but I kind of remember it.
Yeah, live at 54. Well, you know, Chris, I want to thank you. We had a technical difficulty, and we lost
Deborah. I guess she fell out. She got lost in the ether. But anytime you want to get together and bullshit, I'd be happy to also.
My pleasure. Yes, definitely. You're a legend, and I appreciate
thank
you doing
you.
This
likewise.
For us. So
I
on behalf of Sugar Steve and Unpaid Bill and Laia and Fonticolo, this is Questlove of Questlove Supreme. And thank you, Chris and Debbie, for going over your history with us. And we really appreciate it. And we will see you next time, next go around of Questlove Supreme. All right.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.